to the Mariners Library with me, Chris Stanmore-Major. And in this episode, we're continuing the book, The Venturesome Voyages of Captain Voss by Captain J.C. Voss. We're on the second book, on the ninth chapter, and this is the ninth part of the reading. And if you haven't already, please consider going over to patreon.com/themariner, and there for $5 a month, you can help support this podcast and keep the information contained within these fantastic books easily available for the next generation. Now on with the story. Book 2 continued. Chapter 9. Nuuafu and the Fiji Islands. After several days' rest in Samoa, we set sail for the Fiji Islands, a distance of about 600 miles to the westward, and as the easterly trade wind was strong, we soon put the high mountains below the horizon. On the third day, we sighted at daybreak the island of Nuuafu, and as it was right in our track, we sailed round the north side of it, and beheld quite a large village on the western side. We at once altered our course for the village, and on reaching it, found a good anchorage in 15 fathoms, with perfectly smooth water. The chief came to pay us a visit in a canoe, while other natives swam, and amongst the swimmers was a young native girl. The tilikum was anchored about 200 yards from the shore, and the young woman swam that distance in no time. When the fair maiden reached our vessel, she took hold of the rail and raised herself to the deck in true athletic fashion. She then sat down and said something which I did not understand at first, but later discovered she was asking for tobacco. I gave her a plug of T&B, which she put in her long dark hair, lowered herself into the water, and then went back the same way she had come. The natives of Nuuafu and their habits are very similar to those of Samoa, but their skin is darker in colour. The island is about 5 miles in diameter, with heights of 5,000 feet, and all kinds of tropical plants grow in profusion. The treatment we received was similar to that extended by the inhabitants of the other islands. Having stayed one day in Nuuafu, we sailed for the Fiji Islands and sighted the northern part after a 2 days' voyage, with a strong southeast trade wind. The first island we came to was a small, low coral reef covered with coconut trees, on which the seas were breaking heavily. After passing the southwest end, we saw smooth water on the western side, where we dropped anchor in 3 feet of water. It was 9 o'clock in the morning when we anchored, and my mate at once took a gun and a camera and waded ashore. I stopped on board to clean things up a little, at the same time cooking some dinner. At noon, I fired a few signal shots to let my mate know that dinner was ready, for he was one of those men that never think of eating when out shooting. I waited a little while, and as he did not put in an appearance, fired another double shot, but got no answer. I had a trifle to eat, and then took my gun and went ashore. The place where I landed was a fine coral beach, from the water to the coconut trees about 300 feet wide. I walked across the beach and was soon amongst the coconut trees, where the ground was covered with a kind of coarse grass, and through it ran what looked to me like an old footpath, which led to the interior of the island. Nothing could be heard around except the song of the tropical birds. Still, I was satisfied in my own mind that people were or had been on the island not long before. I fired a few more shots, but there was still no reply. I then continued in the same direction and presently saw something amongst the trees that looked to me like a house. I stopped and looked, but could not see anything moving. Neither could I hear any sound. But as I had 10 shots in my rifle, I picked up courage and walked up to the house. There was no sign of either my mate or anybody else. The little house proved to be one of the real old native huts, and nearby was lying a pile of human bones. The Fiji natives were not long ago considered the worst cannibals in the South Pacific Ocean, and I think the little house on the island must have been a feasting place. After seeing that, I walked back towards the beach and collected a few shells. At 4 o'clock, while about to board the canoe, I saw a shark coming along with his back fin out of the water, and once more I made for the beach. This gentleman was one of the yellow-striped tiger variety, the worst and about the only real man-eating shark there is. He kept swimming round and round the boat. Mr. Shark was not more than 7 to 8 feet long, but I knew that if he ever got hold of me, he could make it pretty warm. I watched him for a while, and by took a shot at him, making a hole through his back fin, after which he left in a hurry, and I returned to the Tillicum unmolested. No sooner was I on board than he was alongside the boat again. I then got my shark hook over the side with a piece of bacon fat attached to it, and the next minute I had him on that hook. As the man-eater kept very quiet, I raised him level with the water, and in that position put a bullet through his head, killing him instantly. After getting the hook out of his mouth, he sank to the bottom. In a very short time, while the water all around was red with blood, I saw sharks, large and small, coming along with their fins out of the water, all making for the carcass. The latter was torn to pieces in no time and eaten by his brothers, after which they all left for deep water retreats. About 6 o'clock my mate returned with a load of birds. The next morning at daybreak we set sail for Suva. The weather was fine and clear, and as the southeast trade wind still continued to aid, we passed island after island during the afternoon. The same afternoon we sighted a vessel on our starboard bow. We watched her for a while, and as she did not change her position, we altered our course to have a closer look. After a while we saw that the vessel was stranded. She proved to be a large sailing vessel, but as she was surrounded by reefs and large breakers dashing all over her, we were unable to get any particulars. On October the 17th, at 9 o'clock at night, we arrived at the entrance of Suva Harbour, but it being a dark and stormy night, hove to outside and sailed in at daybreak. On entering Suva Bay, we were met by a steam launch. The man in charge was Captain Clark, harbour master of Suva, and with him was the Reverend Mr. Williams of New Zealand. I invited the two gentlemen on board. Captain Clark, being a seaman, took into account the size of the Tillicum and stepped into the middle of the cockpit, for which the boat hardly moved. But the Reverend gentleman from New Zealand, nearly 300 pounds in weight, instead of stepping on board in the same way, placed his foot on the gunwale. The Tillicum at once gave way under the weight and put her deck under water. Mr. Williams made a quick step back into the launch, saying he could see quite enough of the Tillicum from there. After conversing a little while, Captain Clark took us in tow and anchored us at the landing place. Suva, which is the capital of the Fiji Islands, is a nice clean little town with a population, I was told, of about 600 Europeans. There, as in Samoa, we were cleared of all harbour dues. We dined that day at the McDonald Hotel, and during the afternoon went to see a dance performed by the native men and women of the Solomon Islands. The dancing and music was a good deal like that I had witnessed in Manahiki and Samoa, but the Solomon natives were not so good-looking as the former. Chapter 10. To the Australian Continent and Disastrous Voyage. On October the 20th, Mr. Luxton came to me and said, "Look here, John, I have got a good seaman to take my place for the run with you to Sydney, and if you are willing to take him along, I propose to take passage on a steamship, and on your arrival there I will join you again and complete the voyage, as I am satisfied now that the Tillicum is quite able to make it." I accepted his proposal, and the next morning my new mate came on board. By the looks of him, he appeared to be what he later on proved himself, a first-class seaman. His name was Louis Beegent, aged 31, a native of Lowchester, Tasmania. I told Beegent to go to work and get the boat ready for sea, saying that we were going to sail during the afternoon. However, having made quite a few friends in Fiji, we did not get away till the following afternoon at 3 o'clock. Captain Clark was good enough to give us a tow out as far as the lighthouse. An hour later, he turned back with his launch, and we, with a moderate southeasterly breeze, shaped our course for Sydney, a distance of about 1,800 miles. Just about sunset, about 7 miles outside the bay, we got into a channel between two islands, and as this looked very dangerous for navigation, I ran close to a beach in smooth water and anchored. The following morning, at daybreak, when we were in the act of getting under sail again, we found that our anchor was foul of the bottom, and were therefore unable to get it up. My mate offered to dive down to clear it, but as the water was full of sharks, I cut the anchor rope instead, and with a fresh easterly breeze, we steered again on our westerly course. The wind kept fresh, and the weather clear until the morning of the 27th, when the sky became cloudy. And during the day, the wind freshened up to a strong breeze. At 10 o'clock that night, I took in the foresail and spanker, and under the mainsail and staysail, with a strong easterly wind and steering southwest, the Tilikum went along quite comfortably, now and then taking over a little water, but nothing to speak of. It was my watch on deck from 8 till 12, and about half an hour before midnight, the compass light went out. As the night was quite clear, with a good many stars shining brightly in the southwest, I picked out one of the stars nearly ahead of the boat and steered by it till my watch came to an end, when I called my mate, who got up and took my place at the rudder. I told him to keep the boat going by the star ahead till the light was fixed up. I then took the box, which contained the compass and light, down to the cabin. My mate was well able to keep the canoe on her course by the stars, so there was no particular hurry about the compass, and instead of getting the lamp lit at once, I lit a cigar for myself, another for my mate, and passed it out to him. I then set to work on the compass light. While I was thus employed, my mate was telling me how he enjoyed the sailing in the Tilikum and how he would like to make the trip to London in her. "If we keep this wind," he said, "we will be in Sydney in time for the Melbourne Cup race. I expect my brother-in-law to be in Melbourne by that time. Perhaps you know him. His name is Castella, and he is in command of the American ship Hawaiian Island." "Oh, I am well acquainted with Captain Castella and his wife," I answered. The ship in question was, at that time, the largest and finest steel ship under the American flag. After that, I became very much interested in my mate, and for a minute forgot all about the compass till he said, "It is getting cloudy ahead of us, so will you pass that compass out?" While we were chatting away, the Tilikum went along at her best, answering her helm beautifully. I had lit the lamp and handed the binnacle out to my mate, who, for a second, let go the tiller in order to place it in front of him on the seat of the cockpit. And just as he put the binnacle back in its place, I saw a large breaking sea coming up near the stern of the boat. Knowing the appearance of the sea that it was a bad one, I shouted loudly, "Hold on!" But before I had the words out of my mouth, the breaker had struck us. I had braced myself in the cabin door to keep the water out, but when the sea struck, it knocked me down. However, I was up in a second to see if any damage had been done on deck. I could not see my mate, and the boat was just about halfway round coming up to the wind. I peered forward, thinking that my mate was getting the sea anchor out or doing some other kind of work, but he was not to be seen. I shouted, but got no answer. I knew then that he was overboard, and of course that he must be to windward, as the boat had been going very fast, and therefore must have left him some distance astern ere she came to the wind. To try and beat back to where he had gone overboard was an impossible task owing to the strong wind and large seas. I therefore put the helm hard down, lowered the sails, and put the sea anchor out to prevent the boat drifting too much, thinking that he might be able to swim to the boat and that this was the only way his life could be saved. I continued calling him by name, but got no reply. All my shouting and calling, which I kept up for a long time, was in vain. Nothing but the sound of the wind, and now and then a breaking sea was to be heard. 10 minutes passed, 20 minutes, 30 minutes, an hour, and still no sign of my unfortunate companion, and then I knew that he was dead. The loss of my mate was partly due to negligence, as I always had a lifeline, one end of which was fastened to the boat and the other end to be put around the helmsman's body. I told him, when he first came on board, never to neglect to put that lifeline around himself whenever he took the rudder, as I always did, and if he had followed my advice, he may have gone overboard from the effects of the sea, but would never have got away from the boat. The sea that took my mate overboard was by no means very dangerous. Of course, there was water enough in it to carry a man away if he was not holding on to anything. However, later on during the cruise, the boat shipped larger seas than this one, but I never again had a deplorable accident of this kind. After I had given up all hope of ever seeing my mate again, I went down to the cabin and there found everything afloat. The bedding was soaked and everything else in the cabin was very wet. I then bailed the Tilikum out, after which I went on deck again and sat down in the cockpit, thinking over the loss I had sustained. I was approaching the southern limit of the southeast trade wind, but instead of a trade wind, it developed into a howling gale during the morning hours. I was just going to have a look at the compass to see if the wind was still in the same direction when I discovered, to my dismay, that the compass and binnacle had gone too. When daylight came and the sun made its appearance on the eastern horizon, I got on top of the cabin deck and took a good look around for my missing mate. But there was nothing to be seen but the large seas with their breaking summits and the passing clouds in the sky above, while the Tilikum, under her sea anchor and a storm sail over the stern, rose bravely to every sea as it came along. At 8 o'clock, I hoisted my little Canadian flag, half-mast, and then proceeded to search for a small pocket compass, which I knew my former companion had when we were hunting in the forest of Vancouver Island. Being unable to find it, it struck me that Mr. Luxton kept the same in one of his valises, and doubtless, without thinking of it, took the compass with him when he left me in Suva. Consequently, I was alone at sea without a compass. My position was then about 600 miles southwest from Suva and about 1200 from Sydney, isolated, no compass to steer by, everything soaking wet, and the boat hove to in a gale. For some time, I was completely taken aback and did not know what to do or what would become of me. The first thought that occurred to me was that I might wait there for a passing vessel. Then again, it struck me that I was out of the track of vessels and might lay there for months and not see one. During the forenoon, the wind abated somewhat, and at midday the sun was shining brightly. I took my quadrant and, getting on top of the cabin deck with one arm round the mast to prevent myself from falling overboard, tried to get the noon altitude. While standing there, watching the sun slowly rising to the meridian to the north of me, I said to myself, "Well, there is north." By facing north, the wind was about 10 points to my right, and the sea was running from the same quarter, which of course made the direction of the wind and the sea from the east-southeast. The latter observation almost satisfied me that I could make a fairly good course by steering in clear weather by the sun, the moon, or stars, and in thick weather do the best I could, steering by the ocean swell. A little after noon, the wind had moderated considerably and the seas had lost their breaking tops. I hauled in my sea anchor and under the fore staysail swung the Tilikum on her course to the south-westward, steering by the ocean swell which was running from the east-south-east. By steering the boat so that the east-south-east swell could strike her 2 points abaft the port beam, this was giving her a south-westerly course. The guides I had to steer by were the sun, the moon, and the stars and the ocean swell, but I soon discovered that the ocean swell was by far the best to keep the boat making a good course. Then again, I was obliged to use the heavenly bodies to get the set of the swell. The only trouble I had in finding the course was when, after I got up from a sleep and found the weather thick and overcast. Still worse was when there was a cross swell, and I was helpless and obliged to heave to until the weather cleared up. For 2 days after the accident, it kept blowing from the east-southeast, and as I was unable to sleep, I kept her going night and day until the third day, when the wind died out and I lay becalmed. From the time of the accident till the calm was 2.5 days, during which time I had no sleep and very little to eat, and that cold, I may say that I was just about played out. I therefore went to work and made myself some warm food and after a fairly good meal, laid down to have a sleep. I laid in my little bunk for quite a while, turning from side to side and thinking over the past few days. However, I eventually dozed off, only to dream about all kinds of things. I thought I saw my lost companion look in at the cabin door, and it gave me an awful start. On looking up the time, I found to my surprise that I had only been asleep about 10 minutes. I tried again and again to sleep, but in vain. However, I laid down for a few hours, and then I fancied I felt a breeze come in through the cabin door, and sure enough, when I got on deck, there was a moderate breeze from the south. The great trouble was that whenever I retired to my bunk to sleep, I could not do so, and when sailing, especially in light winds, I could not keep awake. Still, I set sail and did the best I could to keep the Tilikum going towards Sydney. The wind and weather kept about the same till the following day, and it was in the afternoon while I was nearly asleep when a heavy southerly squall struck the Tillicum under all sail, and over she went on her beam ends. And so did I. It was only through a piece of luck that I did not go overboard, for the boat was on the port tack with the sheets hauled by the wind, and I was sitting on the port side dozing when she went over on her beam ends. Landing against the lee washboards, which kept me from going overboard, I nearly broke my neck. As luck happened, the foremast snapped and the boat righted at once. From the fall I got a kink in the neck and laid for a little while in the cockpit before I was able to realise what had happened. When I came to my proper senses, I looked round and saw the foresail, part of the foremast, the forestaysail, and all the headgear hanging overboard. The mainsail and mizzen were still set, and these, with the aid of the foregear hanging overboard, kept the vessel nicely head to wind. After stripping her of the mainsail and hauling in the mizzen sheet, the Tillicum laid as well as if she was riding at her sea anchor. For the next few hours, while I was thinking of my miserable plight and what would next happen to the Tillicum and myself, I let her drift as she was. By and by, I came to the conclusion that while there is life, there is hope, and where there is a will, there is a way, and picked up all the headgear and sails that were hanging overboard, secured it on deck, and as it kept blowing hard for 2 days, I let the boat drift under her sea anchor and storm sail. All that time I was, of course, unable to do anything toward repairing the damage, but by keeping a little riding light on deck during the night, I got all the sleep I possibly could. Well, that's all for today. I hope you're enjoying the story so far. The next instalment will be available in the Mariner's Library shortly. And remember, of course, you've got all the content over on YouTube and the Mariner podcast, and of course, Patreon at patreon.com/themariner. But for now, wherever you are and whatever you're doing, I hope that you're safe and sound, and I look forward to speaking to you in the next one. Cheers.